Welcome to Breaking on Bass, an offhand joke that became a podcast. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is a man who gives it a whack because he's got a knack, Mr. Chris Dashew.
Hi-ho, fiddle-o.
Also along for the ride is a man who keeps his wife in a pumpkin, Mr. Richard Haddam.
I have no references for this episode. I will not dignify this episode with references to the discussed material.
Richie, quite contrichy.
On this podcast, we discuss the works of Arthur Rankin Jr. and the recently passed Jules Bass, color me surprised, specifically some of their stop motion and animated work. On this episode, we are talking about their first theatrical release, The Wacky World of Mother Goose from 1967. It's an animated film based upon Charles Perrault's stories and nursery rhymes, features such memorable characters as Humpty Dumpty, the little old woman who lives in a shoe, the crooked man, old King Cole, of course, the titular Mother Goose.
Trying to figure out what's the low energy for, Mike? Is the low energy because can I speak for the three of us and say this is the worst thing we've watched?
I got a contact high watching this movie. It was, what were they on when they were making this? It's amazing. Well,
remember when we watched Lord of the Rings?
Yes.
And I said, look, guys, I'm at a disadvantage here. This is an animation style I don't like, based on subject matter I don't care about, that exists in a genre I'm not really a fan of. So you're going to have to really take my opinions with a grain of salt. Well, welcome to the wacky world of Mother Goose, an animation style that is fairly repellent, based on stories that actually have almost no relevance now. And here we all are. And it actually made me think, what was it about Mother Goose? When I was growing up, now I just turned 56 years old, okay? But I grew up with fractured fairy tales, and I grew up with all this stuff, so that I had a working knowledge of this stuff. But let me ask you guys, do kids today have any idea who the hell Mother Goose is?
You know, I don't know if they do or not.
I don't think they do.
I didn't know who Mother Goose was. Like, I don't know what the story of Mother Goose is. I didn't know that there was, let me put it this way. I would assume that there was not some sort of overarching narrative within the Mother Goose story. My assumption was Mother Goose was just a care. I do not know who Mother Goose is. That is not something I learned about. I am the youngest one here.
Right.
Mike, you are the middle one here. Did you have any frame of reference for Mother Goose going into this?
Oh, 100 times. Yeah.
Okay.
I had a big old book of Mother Goose stories. I knew every single one of these rhymes. Was overly familiar with all of them. As soon as somebody would come on screen, I'd be like, oh, that's got to be Little Jack Horner. Oh,
right. There's I know those stories, but I didn't know that they were like Mother Goose stories. Little Jack Horner sat in the corner eating his curds away, yada, yada. Jack and Jill went up the hill. Like, let me put it this way. I know those stories, but I didn't know that this was somehow a Mother Goose stories. I just, you know, Humpty Dumpty went up a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. Like, but you just know that. Like, inherently, you know that, I guess.
But isn't that weird? Like inherently, we know it. But I promise you, I mean, I think that if you walk up to a 10-year-old right now and you go, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, they will give you a blank stare. Hmm. Now, I'm not holding that against this. It was interesting to me as I was watching it going, you know, I never liked these when I was a kid. It's not like these were the stories that enchanted me the most. And I couldn't get Little Jack Horner out of my head. They baffled and bored me back then. They seemed hopelessly out of date 50 years ago. And so now to watch this, I was sort of left thinking, well, clearly they were like, look, this is sort of stuff in the public domain. It's not going to cost us anything. The IP is free. All the kids know it. It's welcome material. This is a way for us to do a special, fulfill an obligation, make some money. And it's really, you know, win-win. There's no downside to any of this. That had to be the thinking, right?
Even if we talk about something that I think Rankin and Bass is more well-known for, like Frosty, which they created, Rudolph, which they created. I mean, those were concoctions created by them in the vein of these stories. Yeah, like
right.
I don't know how else you would describe Frosty and Rudolph. I mean, I guess they're holiday stories, but they're still kind of folksy tales of characters of holiday bent, as opposed to whatever the fuck Humpty Dumpty. I don't understand what is he's a fucking egg that falls off a wall, but why? But why is he an egg that falls off a wall?
I'm sure millions of books have been written about the psychological underpinnings. I'm sure Bruno Bettelheim has written volumes on the Mother Goose stories, but it is weird because it brings up a bigger point, I think, that I began to realize not so long ago, that if you roll back to the middle of the last century, if you go back to the 1950s, there were certain things that, quote unquote, everybody knew. One of those things was the Bible. Okay. One of those things was Paradise Lost. One of those things were, maybe the Greek myths, but there were things in the Western literature canon that every student learned. And then when you went to high school and college, you learned them almost even more. They were the bedrocks of Western literature. The Bible was studied in a weird way as Western literature, either in church, or you just knew it. If someone made a remark about the Garden of Gethsemane, you would go, "Oh, I get what you're talking. I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it." Okay.
Well, it's cultural literacy.
It's cultural literacy, and it doesn't exist anymore. Cultural literacy for kids now is
Harry Potter, bro.
And Marvel. That's what people do. That's what people turn to as IP, that it's like, we can do Spider-Man and Batman. You're talking about things that in Superman, you look at those logos and they're known around the world. Batman is known. Superman is known. And we're in a very
or even
different
Star
world.
Wars or Mickey Mouse. I mean, again, it's the common modern mythology. That's I always say to people, if not for the fact that the Bible is the text that people glommed onto, you could use the Silmarillion as a basis for a religious text just as easily. Sure. It has similar stories about characters overcoming problems in their lives or overwhelming problems in society. And like, there's nothing different. The Bible is the same thing. It happens to have a religion based around it. But there are people that honestly believe in the quote Jedi religion, unquote, and consider themselves Jedis, as Mike rolls his eyes correctly. But those people exist too. I mean, and again, like, is it any less valid? But like, to both of your points, that it speaks to the, I guess, just commonplace. People would be able to tell who Mickey Mouse is before they said who Jesus is.
Right. And there was this, it's also about, American culture, turn the clock back 50 years, kids had nothing. Kids got Saturday morning and maybe they got Sunday night, wonderful world of Disney. Okay. That's what you got. No one really gave a shit what a kid was interested in because you were a kid and the world wasn't about kids. Now that changed and that's not the truth anymore. Now, little kid. I mean, it started with teenage culture and then it worked its way down. And now there's a lot of stuff served up to little kids and, toddlers and the ones just above that and the tweens and the preteens and the teens and the whole thing. This was made, I guarantee, if I was 6 years old and my parents told me, "Oh, you know what? There's a special on tonight. It's for kids. It's animated." I would have been thrilled.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be like, what? Someone did something for me, right?
But that's how it was last night watching this. I was thrilled.
Did you actually like this?
Come on. Tell me if you're true. Tell me if this is not a joke.
I was enthralled by this movie,
especially
the Crooked Man and all those weird knights. The way the Crooked Man was moving was freaking me out. This is an awful movie. This is terrible. And the character design is wretched. Just
especially
so
Mother Goose, like the titular character, it looks like a flesh puddle, like a flesh pile, with a definitionless weird short creature.
She kind of looks like Margaret Rutherford, who voiced her, but like the mouth movements, the lip flap, as they say in the business, was not there. It was awful. But just looking at like Jack Horner and Mary Mary Quite Contrary, like those two have like these little dot eyes. And then you look at Mother Goose and the Crooked Man or Princess Harmony, and they all have like these circular eyes. And I'm just like, make a choice. Would you make a choice which way these characters are going to look? And Princess Harmony, I felt so bad for this girl because she had no nose whatsoever.
I mean, just, she has that weird mouth, too. That, like, strange, like, constant, like, puckered asshole mouth.
Yeah.
The Crooked Man is the most interesting part of this entire special, both from a design standpoint, but also from a what his design informs on other characters' design, the voice that Bradley Bulkey is doing. And on top of everything else, he is the villain that some of these specials kind of needed that they didn't get. He's an interesting villain who's just a bastard to the end. And some of these specials had these weird redeemable villains that didn't really serve the narrative. I appreciate that this villain is just, he's a bastard through and through, and he makes no bones about it. He takes everybody's parents away, and he said, they're not coming back, and Mother Goose, until she comes back, nobody can do anything. Like, I kind of like that.
So what, I mean, quite obviously, who did he remind you of? Design-wise.
A little Snidely Whiplash for me.
Yeah.
Didn't he remind you of the magician in Frosty?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this whole thing with her stopping and looking at the camera and being like, who am I? Well, I'm Mother Goose. And I'm like, oh, my God, here we go again.
My wife literally went, since when is Mother Goose a witch, is what she said. Because she looks like a witch, doesn't she?
Right. With the buckle on the hat.
Yeah, or like a fucking pilgrim or something.
Right.
Like, yeah. So Mother Goose is...
She's not the ruler, but she's basically the power behind the throne of old King Cole.
I guess so. I was trying to figure out, like, who is Mother Goose in this story? She's like a demigod, I guess. Like, she's more powerful than everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Romeo Muller had to invent all this because Mother Goose was sort of an invented host.
Right, she's like the crypt keeper,
exactly. She's the crypt keeper. It's like okay, I've got all of these stories that have been passed down, you know, oral tradition, and you know, they're not quite grim fairy tales, and a lot of them are just sort of like based on little rhymes that I think people said to their kids to sort of calm them down and, you know, make them go to sleep or stop crying or whatever. But they were clearly compiled into a volume and given a narrative umbrella, you know, of Mother Goose. Here is who is bringing this to you, and you can trust her and feel good about the product. And so there was no story to fall back on. I mean, in the other ones, that, you know, like Rudolph and, well, maybe not Frosty, but there's at least a little bit of a narrative that you could borrow. But
they created that. Again, those were like Frosty and Rudolph. Weren't they created whole cloth, essentially? Based off of songs, I guess, right? Yes. But again, like, songs. But a song is, a full-length song is better than Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. Two more lines worth of stuff. Like, there is less there than in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
I mean, look at what they do in Shrek. They're able to use those characters in that world in a much better way than they do in this world.
This is terrible Shrek. It really is. Like,
yeah.
It really is like a very crappy progenitor to Shrek. I mean, again, it's crappy for a number of reasons. The animation style, Toei animation, I don't know what the hell happened here.
Oh, man.
But it's awful. Like, so directionless and weirdly jumbled. Like Mike mentioned, just describing all the characters. Humpty Dumpty, my God, what a awful character design and a weird and off-putting character too, because he's not supposed to be a villain, but he's like, I'm Humpty Dumpty, and it's like, it's just awful to look at, and it's very unsettling.
And what's up with his voice? Because sometimes he sounds like Buddy Hackett and other times he doesn't, and I'm just like, what are you going for here? Was that Bob McFadden doing that voice? Who's a great voice artist.
Yeah, one of the voice artists, right? And it's just, oh God, I don't know, man.
It feels like this was structured almost like a Bob Hope special. You know, it was just like, we just got to keep bringing on the guest stars,
right?
You know, and it doesn't matter. It's like, okay, you like Jack Horner, now meet Little Bo Peep. Okay, now we got this one. Now we got that one. Here
best
comes Humpty
one.
Dumpty.
Hey, diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle. That was like the stretch of stretches. Is all of a sudden there's a cat playing a fiddle, and I was like, oh my God, really, really, we're going there? Like, all right. Mm-hmm. And
of course they're going to where else are they going
to
go?
What's the problem? There is nowhere for this to go. Even when it tries to go somewhere, it goes nowhere. The story is threadbare, to say the least, because it essentially boils down to Mother Goose leaves to go see her sister. Bad things happen. The minute Mother Goose comes back, she fixes everything immediately. And you're just sitting and wondering okay, so the tension was what again? That Mother Goose was just gone a little longer than she said she would be?
Well, and this was, trying to get into the heads of the people who made it and what the whole idea was. It's like, if a little kid is sitting in front of the TV and watching this, there's a general sense of danger, which is all it takes. I mean, for a little kid, that's all it takes. You're riveted. You're terrified. And then with each character that comes around, the kids are like, oh, yeah, I know that one. Oh, I know that one. And there, I have to imagine there was a real feeling of, wow, this film is speaking to me. This film knows my world. It's not all that weird, boring stuff that the grownups watch at night where I have to go to bed and they're watching, Hawaii 5-0. This is for me, This isn't Bonanza. So the more characters that come out that I recognize, I guess the happier I am as a kid. And again, it costs them nothing because this is just public domain IP. So in a way, they did the smartest thing they could, which was just like, okay, let's just create something that'll allow us to just parade all the characters through as quickly as possible. Bring Mother Goose back. She saves the day. Everyone loves Mother Goose. Good night, everybody.
Well, and the other thing about this, if you think about it, because we already talked about it at one point on this show. I'm trying to remember the name. What was the name of the Hans Christian Andersen thing that they did?
Oh, right.
The Daydreamer? Was that it?
Yes.
They did that before this.
Even that was better. And those stories are slightly more obscure because the kids, Hans Christian Andersen is a little like one half step removed. I mean, that's a little bit more toward Grimm, that sort of weird Northern European, what's going on? Why am I worried about the little match girl?
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that, Little Mermaid, right? That's one of the Hans Christian Andersen stories.
Right.
Right. They really beat into the ground in that. The one that they beat into the ground in this one is Jack Horner. Like, what a memorable character. He sat in the corner. That's all he fucking did.
Whoa. He was eating. He sat in the corner. What was he doing?
Eating his curds and whey or eating his pudding.
Christmas you're mixing
pudding?
Him up with
Little Miss Muffet.
Little Miss Muffet. Yeah.
Sat on her tuffet. Now,
Tuffet. Where was she? That's not a story, apparently. A Mother Goose.
I've been married. I just want to say I've been married for years. I've yet to locate the tuffet.
What is a tuffet?
Most men have problems with that. Little Jack Horner sat in the corner eating his Christmas pie. His thumb, pulled out a plum, and said, "What a good boy am I?" Yeah.
Okay. So now here's what. Okay. Think about that for a second. That there is nothing going on there.
No.
That is literally something you say to hypnotize a child to go to sleep. Take it from a man who's had three kids. You'll do anything. You will sing anything, say anything, do anything just to keep a tone rolling that will hypnotize the child to suddenly go, ow.
I'm surprised that they didn't use Perrault's other films or his other stories, I should say, because he wrote Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, Puss in Boots, Sleeping Beauty, Bluebeard, which is really fucking dark.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, hey, we're just sticking with the nursery rhymes here, which appropriately enough are, to your point, Richard, like 4 or 5 years old, trying to figure out all the words to these things and knowing them by heart, but not knowing why. Why do I know all of these things? Why do I have all of these rhymes stuck up in my head? Like what, like when they got to the Peter Pumpkin Eater, I'm just like, wait, he sticks his wife in a pumpkin because he couldn't keep her? What?
Yeah. You got to figure. I mean, I'm sure there were ways to, you teach kids sounds and rhymes and it's early reading and it's early spelling probably. Mm-hmm. And it was just this sort of received volume of material that existed in a world that was not about children. It's not like it had to battle with, you know, Bugs Bunny.
Right. Or Paw Patrol.
Yeah, Paw Patrol. Oh, my God. I mean, you know, I mean, I couldn't even tell you what's been going on the last 20 years.
Or Teletubbies, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, you know, Barney, the purple dinosaur.
The rhyming purple dinosaur. I love you. You love me. We're a happy family. I mean,
yeah.
I didn't even, you know, I don't know why the term Mike hadn't said nursery rhyme. Nobody had said nursery rhyme until you just said it, Mike. This is like, how do you make a fucking cartoon special off of nursery rhymes? You can't, because this is what happens.
Well, but it's weird. But it follows the same logic of, let's do Year Without a Santa Claus. You say Santa Claus, and you've got 99.9% of the children in the Western world's full attention. Uh-huh. Why burn a lot of calories trying to invent something new when you can just sort of walk up and go, okay, kids, you've all heard of this? Well, then, sit on down.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but Hey Diddle Diddle, the Cat and the Fiddle leaves not a lot to go off of.
Right, right.
Cat and the Fiddle.
Cow over the moon and a dog laughing. Yeah, and then a dish and a spoon.
Yeah.
The fork ran away with the spoon. Along came a spider. No,
that's the problem with all of this is, like, some of these I expected also some of these to show up, like Three Blind Mice didn't show up. Not that kind of nursery rhyme.
Well, she's so lazy that her clock isn't working, so she has to go to the cupboard, let the one mouse out so it'll run up the clock, and then the clock will strike one, and then she's all set. I'm like, wow, lady, you could just like wake up the clock, or, you know, turn the hands on there. But yeah,
okay, look, you guys don't have kids. I had kids over the course of the past 25-26 years. Never read them a single Mother Goose nursery rhyme. Never did it because I didn't need to. If I wanted to share time with my kids, even when they were little, I'd turn on The Simpsons. You know, it's like, that's the other thing, is that there's not a separation anymore. So it's not like, well, for a child, you read them these things and they like it and then they grow out of it. For an adult, it's like, well, but why am I wasting my time when I could just show them something I like? It's like, guys, I know you're only two, but this is Star Trek. And one day you'll be glad you know what the hell it is. And you just show them whatever you like that isn't, you know, Friday the 13th. And, you know, if it's not too loud and scary or whatever, you enjoy it. And that's it. I mean, that's to me, that's the value of Rankin and Bass is that when Christmas rolls around, as it is, you know, it's coming down the pike, this was something I could show the kids because Santa Claus still has a little bit of cachet. By the way, losing more every year, but it's got a little cachet. Kids know it. It's benevolent. They're not afraid. They're willing to listen. And so I could show my kids Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. They didn't fall in love with the way I did, but they tolerate it, you know, and Charlie Brown. You know, I could show them Charlie Brown for a few years until they, you know, flat out rejected that because it wasn't cynical enough. Meanwhile, Susan and I are weeping.
As you do.
Mm-hmm.
Look, my God, these kids are trying to be nice to each other.
I mean, that's fair. You know, it's strange to me because, again, Rankin and Bass normally, even when they misstep, they don't misstep this hard. And the, you know, that Frosty cartoon, not the original one, but the second, wasn't there another Frosty cartoon that was not great? I forget, it was
Weekend at Frosty's.
Yeah, it was the one with Jack Frost in there. I can't remember which one, like,
that was kind of a misstep. And then there were, you know, the Leprechaun's Christmas Gold, which I don't even know if we've talked about yet, but
let me pop the
Art Carney
right
and
now.
Blarney Killarney it. And Killakadarney and Banarney or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of missteps that I get from Rankin and Bass, where it's just kind of it's kind of a nothing burger. It's not much of anything. It's just, you know, it comes and it goes. It's 30 minutes of time. And by the end of it, you know, I've been mildly entertained, but it's over with. This is like an hour and a half. You know, this overstays its welcome for me by like 2x.
Yeah. Yeah. I was surprised when I saw that this was a feature length film. And I think going through the list of all of their stuff, I think this is the last feature film that we have to. Oh, I take it back. There's one more, The King and I from 1999. But this is one of the last ones that we have to talk about. And then we've done all of the live action stuff now. So we're chugging through this, guys.
Look, here's what I think. And we and for the listener, we, you know, Chris and Mike and I have discussed a little bit of this offline, because I sort of felt like, you know, I mean, we're recording this in early November, and we're obviously coming into the holiday season, and I think Rankin and Bass, for all of their massive output, are primarily known as sort of the keepers of the childhood, you know, animagic Christmas specials. And I was kind of pushing for, why don't we revisit them maybe for another angle? And then you guys, or maybe Chris, it was you who suggested, why don't we do Night Before Christmas and Cricket on the Hearth, which are holiday ones that we haven't done yet, mm-hmm. which I think is a great idea. And maybe we also, we do that. And then, because we're not prepared on this podcast, because unfortunately his passing was just a few days ago, but maybe we do just like a little salute to Jules Bass and kind of, you know, provide maybe a little bit of biographical information that we haven't really leaned into, and just kind of, you know, tip our hat and raise a glass to you know, half of our bad pun that led to a long running podcast.
Well, and it's funny, like Mike mentioned in the intro, it's not that we don't keep up with these things, but there's an assumption that when we're talking about stuff that took place in the 60s, and these were people that were, you know, between my age and y'all's age then, that they have long left us, that no, Jules Bass, like, holy shit, what? Well,
mea culpa.
These guys stick around.
I looked him up and I thought that he was gone, or else I would have tried to reach out for an interview, because we've been doing this for, what, 2 years now, I think?
Well, since before the pandemic, dude.
Yeah. So it's so like, years, had I known, I would have, you know, reached out. Because
are any of those guys alive? Is Romeo Muller alive?
No, I don't think so.
Rankin is not?
I mean, obviously, I'm not reliable, because
neither one of us are, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's so funny. I mean, you can find out in 2 seconds just by Googling it, but I think we all just assume, well, they couldn't possibly be alive.
Rankin passed away in 2014, and Romeo Muller passed away in 92. So of the big three, of Bass, Muller, and Rankin, Bass was the last. But to be fair, he was 87, and we all know, well, Mike and I know, and I'm sure you as well, Richard, the longer people are around, the less people want to do stuff like this, i.e. interacting and dealing with people in the old days and technology and interviews. And, you know, some people are into it and some people love talking. Mike and I have run into those people, but also run into people who are, I'm retired and I'm not doing anything. So don't even bother. Looking at you, Gene Hackman.
I'm getting a lot of...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You also get a lot of, I'm writing my memoirs, so I'm not talking to anyone right now. And then years pass, and it's like, whatever happened to that memoir you were writing, dude?
I ran into a guy last night at a party who and we, you know, he also works in the entertainment industry, and he's from the UK. We were talking, and suddenly he's like, well, you know, I know Joan Collins. And I'm like, okay. What? He's like, yeah. I'm like, how old is she? Like, oh, she's 87. I'm like, does she want to come on a podcast called 80s TV Ladies, produced by Weirding Way Media? And he's like, yeah, sure, for a price.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, if Jules Bass may have said, hey, hey. Pay me, right. but
it's like, well, pay you how much do you want, you know? If it's more than $100, we're gonna have to talk to someone.
I think I can still say I've never paid for an interview. I believe you're the same, Mike. You've never paid for an interview, right?
Well, technically, I helped out some guys who were making a documentary by paying for an interview for them to do it, but then part of that agreement was, and you have to come on my podcast. So
yeah.
Are you the kind of guys, are you just bragging that you've never had to pay for it?
I mean, I've had to pay for other things.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah, yeah. But, because, no, why would you pay for an interview? This is publicity.
No, right. Because in the words of Charlie Sheen, what you're paying for is for them to go away.
More, I mean, pretty much.
I think that holds with podcast interview.
Yeah, bro's got tiger blood. I'm not going to mess with him.
Yeah. I think more than anything else, I was just, you know, I was surprised that Jules Bass is still around, but it says that he was still active, that he was still working up until 2022. I mean, I don't put a lot of stock into that, but yeah, I think what's more surprising, I think it caught a lot of us off guard. And Otto Bruno, who has been on the Barney Miller show, actually mentioned to me about talking about, you know, Jules Bass a little bit. And I think to your point, Richard, it, you know, would behoove us to probably maybe mention who Jules Bass was. Cause yeah, kind of, we fucking dropped the ball. I mean, none of us knew. So
to a certain degree this podcast is preaching to the choir. No one's tuning in who doesn't sort of love the material. And there's a Facebook group that is very knowledgeable and dedicated to Rankin and Bass. And so I feel like in a way we've sort of just proceeded forward as if everyone sort of knows everything and understands who Rankin and Bass was. But maybe just even for a brief portion of a podcast, we can sort of circle back and sort of go, okay, for those of you who might be somehow stuck somewhere over Christmas and you're just listening to this and you've seen Rudolph, but you don't really know who these guys are or what their passions were or why they devoted themselves so stringently to this art form of animagic and what their relationship was with the Japanese animators and how they even got into it. There might be a little bit of a story there to enjoy over the holidays. And then at the same time, also revisit a couple of their classics we haven't really talked about. I mean, why not? We're getting into that season. Let's curl up by the fire and, you know, pour ourselves a hot toddy, if you will, and talk about the guys who kind of played an integral role in our childhoods, for sure mine.
Well, and the other thing that's kind of crazy about all of this is, again, like Rudolph and Frosty are songs, but the songs become part of the special. But the special, the stories in those specials are what everybody remembers. I mean, everybody, because again, you know, the totally not gay elf is not in the song. You know, that's not part of the song. You know, Yukon Cornelius, not part of the song either. I mean, these are things that are invented for that special that end up being as memorable. Hermie the Elf is as memorable as Rudolph. And what's insane is, look at this. They didn't try here to do anything more with any of these characters. Frankly, the way you do this story is you have a kid from the real world go into the Mother Goose world of stories. And that's how you do this story. Because then it's those kids, like you've been talking about, Richard, the kids who you and Mike were or you know of at the time, who knew these stories, going, oh yeah, there's the Dumpty, oh yeah, there is Mother Goose, and you already know who they are, and it's a little kid interacting with them as opposed to them interacting with themselves, and it falling very flat and not interesting.
And look, by the 60s, because these stories are so old and date back so far, you could even go with the angle of the wised up kid who didn't believe in all this fairy tale.
Right.
And then by the end, he's like, oh my gosh, Mother Goose, I love you. You know, I mean, it's not, here's the thing, you know, Romeo Muller wrote the screenplay here. I'm a big fan of Romeo's. I actually think that he hit it right on the head. Especially with Rudolph and Frosty. Thematically, he goes straight to the point. He's like, Rudolph is a story of a misfit who is underestimated, feels unloved, feels totally shut out. I mean, that's what's poignant about the story. Let's push the walls back on that. Let's bring in an elf. Let's bring in an old miner. Let's bring in a handful of characters who are essential to the story, who also feel or could be seen as misfits. And then let's go one step further. Let's go to the island of misfits. And let's really, because guess what? Every kid feels like a misfit.
Mm-hmm.
There is, I mean, it's genius. That is why this endures in the same way that a Charlie Brown Christmas endures, because it sort of counterintuitively plugs into kids feeling weird about Christmas. I mean, I was a depressed kid. I had no trouble identifying with Charlie Brown and going, yeah, I love Christmas too, but it's weird. There's this weird existential sadness that comes with Christmas. And when I watched Charlie Brown, I didn't know. I didn't sit back and go, ah, yes, he's connecting with me in this particular way. I just knew that I liked that that was getting voiced, and I liked that it was getting resolved. Mm-hmm. I liked that his friends were aware of it, heard him, and came around and said, you know what, Charlie Brown, we hear you now. You're depressed, but we get it, and we're here for you. We got your back on this. We're going to make it a great Christmas, and we're going to stop making you feel terrible. And for, let me tell you, for a little Richie Haddam, that was storytelling gold, as was Rudolph, as was, and even, look, Frosty is not as, you know, potent a Christmas symbol. And the theme of magic, though, at least they exploited it. They said, okay, what is Frosty the Snowman about? It's about magic. Okay, what do we got there? Evil magician. Okay, he's the bad guy. Because he's fake magic, but Frosty's the real magic. Let's talk about that. That's really great. I give full kudos to that creative approach to these specials. And I think Romeo does a great job with the vast majority of these. Which, of course, is why this one was a little disappointing.
Well, and I don't know what the message is in this one, because, like you just mentioned, mm-hmm. I think you would agree, Mike. Like, and the other ones, as maybe kind of simple hearted or, you know, kind of hopeful, the message is, you know, be good to one another, be kind to one another, yada yada yada. There's none of that here. I don't know what it is. It's just without. I'm not going to say it's without a heart, but there is no emotional core at the center of this, because Mother Goose is not present and Jack Horner is not much of a character. And I'm not willing to concede that Humpty Dumpty is the emotional core of this story, because Humpty Dumpty is just off-putting.
Right. No, if anybody's supposed to be there, it's Jack and Mary, I think. And I could give a shit about both of them. And sorry, Maury Laws, but the songs kind of suck.
Oh, God. This. Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, again, when Rudolph and Frosty are created from the song that's already so good, you know that song is going to be in there. But then in those specials, they augment it with all those other fucking song, like We're Just a Couple. I mean, that's the one that everybody remembers outside of Rudolph.
Silver and Gold is a fucking fantastic song.
Oh my God, yeah. But then you come to this and it's just nothing. Like, I couldn't tell you any of the songs in this special. None of them.
And apparently I was wrong. This wasn't Maury. This was Jules and another gentleman whose name I'm looking at right now.
George Wilkins.
George Wilkins. Thank you.
The music in this is not good. The music in this is, and it's not even a matter of good or bad. It's just wholly unforgettable, which is bad. I mean, the fact that
wholly
there's
unforgettable or wholly forgettable.
Wholly forgettable. Batman.
Yeah. Fair. I can't even tell you one of the songs.
Well, yeah, there's that weird one where it's Jack and Mary going back and forth, and it's a give the boy a break or something. But then when she's singing it, she's also singing Give the Boy a Break. And I'm like, wait, no, this is weird.
Okay. So here's from the book, The Enchanted World of Rankin Bass, a portfolio. This is actually from the first paragraph covering Mad Monster Party. Okay. So just hear me out. In reference to Mad Monster Party, it says, this is one of the best loved Rankin Bass Animagic productions. Released in 1967, Mad Monster Party was a feature film distributed through Embassy Pictures Corporation with Joseph E. Levine as executive producer. Mm-hmm. Quote from Rankin, Joseph was a very successful entrepreneur at that time and was anxious to get into the, quote, family market. As he called it, we made The Daydreamer and The Wacky World of Mother Goose and Mad Monster Party with Joe. And it was an interesting experience. He was a colorful fellow and we had a good time. And I think we all made a few pennies.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I think this gives us a little bit of look, it's called show business, not show charity, but it gives us a little bit of an insight into why things like Mad Monster Party and Wacky World of Mother Goose, and then back to The Daydreamer, why they got made. Because a producer saw Joe Levine, was like, hey, wait a second. I think there may be an underserved market. Can you guys help me? And it sounds like these were not unsuccessful theatrical releases because they all made a few pennies.
Right.
So no one was like, yeah, that was a disastrous collaboration that we never should have pursued. I think this one made money, guys.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, how much money did they put into it? Not very much.
Compared to the Animagic ones, I've got to assume. And what's crazy is, you know, we watched something like Willie McBean, right? That was, you know, 65. I would take that over this. I would take the Daydreamer over this. I would take Mad Monster Party over this, frankly.
Ooh, that's a tough choice.
it's a tough choice, but I think I think for me, ultimately, with something like The Wacky World of Mother Goose, it comes down to three things. The expectations I have when we're talking a Rankin and Bass film. Good music, or at least some semi-memorable music, which this has none of. A kind of a heartwarming message, even if the message is, you know, tailored for a childhood audience or a younger audience. This doesn't have that either. And then the third is quality voice acting, which all of these tend to have, even when they're not great. And this is the first time I think I can say the voice acting has been subpar, even with Bob McFadden, even with Bradley Bulkey playing the Crooked Man, the more interesting of the characters, even with Margaret Rutherford, who, fantastic actress. Nobody brings anything to any of this. It's like they're sleepwalking through it. And it's a shame, really, because like we've kind of mentioned, there is a story that could be told here. It would have to be told with 1967 sensibilities, not 1947 sensibilities, which is clearly the sensibilities the adults here, Joseph Levine and friends and Bass and Rankin and Muller, they were all bringing adult sensibilities to these stories by telling them in a very pared down and boring way. And I think there was a better way of telling these stories at the core of this that they sailed on by because they were just doing the absolute minimum amount of work. The minimum amount of work is what we get here. Like it's so workmanlike, it's not even funny.
So to your point about the voice acting, here are the voice actors in The Daydreamer. You ready? Tallulah Bankhead, Victor Borga, Margaret Hamilton, Burl Ives, Boris Karloff, Edwin, Ray Bolger, and that's only half of them. I mean,
this is
star studded.
This has Margaret Rutherford, and that's it.
That's pretty much it. And what's funny, I'll show you here. There's a one sheet that they would put up, and I want to call your attention to this one thing right there: Saturday, Sunday matinee only.
Yeah, yeah. And Margaret Rutherford's name is front and center on that thing.
Yeah,
totally. And nothing against Margaret Rutherford, but typically they try to fill out. You know, it's like, well, let's get in this guy and let's get even Paul Frees. It's like, well, let's just get in a guy who's really good, even if he's not a celebrity. He doesn't have to be Fred Astaire or, you know, whoever, you know, Shirley Booth. Let's just get someone in there. And this one, they really didn't do that. And it shows.
It feels like the first feature film that they've done. It is the first feature length that they've done. But here's the thing. They had done other things before this. They had done Willie McBean. They had done all the other, they had done a lot of them. They had done Rudolph and Frosty by now, had they not? Like long before this. Like what's weird is this feels like such a poor showing. And I would understand if this was a poor showing, if this was your actual first thing you'd ever done and you've never really done anything else.
Yeah. No, this was a couple of years later. And I really think, I mean, if you hear what Rankin was saying in that interview, what I'm hearing is it was the second of these three movies that he was referring to. And it was sort of like, why spend all that money? Let's spend as little as we can, make as much as we can, and get the hell out of town before anyone figures it out.
but still crazy.
Little Henry Hill.
Well, but it's crazy because they still have better voice actors in those other two. So this is the one that they just, this is the one where they just said, meh, whatever.
Yeah. This was the cash grab. This was, oh, now it's getting a little too easy. And then, you know, I don't know if Mad Monster Party put an end to that, but you know, they you know, look, their fortunes, you know, dipped and rose. But yeah, this was 2 years after Rudolph. You know, yeah. So I mean, there's no excuse.
I think this has, for me, taken a spot as the worst non-live action thing we've seen. The length alone makes it really hard to find it anything other than just kind of by the time you get to the end of it, I was more annoyed than anything else. I was like, can we just get to the end of the story, please? Because nothing is entertaining. Nothing is exciting here. You're not even giving me anything to chew on as an audience member. It feels like you're just rushing to the end even.
I think it has to be 80 minutes to be a feature release. It can't be any shorter. And that's fairly, I mean, that's in the modern era. You know, I mean, there were Marx Brothers movies that clocked in at like, you know, 68 minutes. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, it's like now, I mean, you've seen movies that have been made in the last, you know, 30 years where the end titles are really long just to get it over the, it's like, we're 88 minutes, we got it, or whatever the limit is, you know, so yeah. Not great, but hey, we still love Rankin and Bass, and we're going to come at you with some holiday content, so just you wait and see.
Well, on that note, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I want to thank Abby Stabby for our artwork, as well as the Great Octopus for our theme music. Be sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. We'll be back next month with that holiday content, with a look at Twas the Night Before Christmas and The Cricket on the Hearth. Until then, be sure to rate and review the podcast wherever you get it. Tell your friends, tell your family, and stay weird.